I'd like to call Senate State Affairs Committee to order today. It's Thursday, May 2nd, 2019. Let the record reflect times 3:35 p.m. Today we have President Senator Michicki, Senator Reinbold, Senator, Vice Chair Senator Cocco, myself, Joe Schauer. I'd like to remind everybody, please turn off or silence your cell phones. With staff assisting us today, we've got Carrie up front with Senate Records. We've got Eric behind us with the LIO. And as always, we have our faithful sidekick, Jake, who's been working in State Affairs for us as his 21-year-old intro to work in the building. He's doing a good job. There's one item on today's agenda, and that's going to be to get an initial rollout for SB 116, Ballot Custody Tampering Voter Registration. We're going to bring up SB 116, Ballot Custody Tampering Voter Registration, sponsored by myself. I'm going to have my staff come up to the table. Both of you can go ahead and come up and put yourself on the record. I'm going to give a few opening remarks, and then we're going to walk through the bill. All right, gentlemen, before you get started, I'll give some opening comments for the record. As we go through an act relating to elections and voter registration, designating as a Class C felony the intentional opening or tampering with certain election materials and providing for an effective date. I'm not going to read everything here. I will say we've been working closely with the governor's office, with the lieutenant governor specifically, as we're trying to make the election system itself tighter, make it more transparent, and try to get it as airtight as we can get it, because as everybody knows, making sure that we have integrity in our election system is a big deal. We believe every vote counts. We have some gaps in the current law, and there's always the possibility that that can change the outcome of recent elections. Some people would say that, you know, well, my vote doesn't matter, that you can look at this last election cycle, and there was some votes, some election races were decided by one vote. Some of them were within a few dozen. It does matter. So every vote matters, and I believe even one of those votes that reversed an election was a prior felon. So it does make a big deal, or it's a big deal. Other elections in recent past have been called into question because of the protocol policy. So that's one of the things we're looking at. And so as we go through this, we're looking for SB 116 to codify chain of custody protocols and the handling of ballots and election reports. We'll be trying to mandate that all ballots are in a strict chain of custody all the way back to a central location where they can be destroyed after all ballots have been accounted for by the election board. Current practice allows ballots to be destroyed in the precinct without central accounting, so we kind of lose touch with what could be happening to them. It requires the director to establish and regulation best practices for chain of custody protocols, provides affected parties reasonable notice for ballot handling observation opportunities, which we heard about in the last election cycle. There were some issues with that. It establishes an election offense hotline number that is conspicuously posted at polling areas and on the election privacy envelopes. It deputizes citizens, and every voter becomes empowered. If they see something, they can now effectively say something. It requires election workers to immediately notify the director of any irregularities, and then allows for an audit of ballots in precinct immediately after the election. A couple of the other highlights: requires reasonable notice to affected parties of ballot handling at a chain of custody. Eliminates mandatory PFD voter registration and converts it to an opt-in. We're going to talk about this as we go. Codifies the Division of Elections to notify voters if their ballot was not counted. Does not allow the director or lieutenant governor to certify the results until every ballot has been accounted for. Requires electronic and paper ballots to be destroyed at a single location only after the director expressly authorizes destruction and subsequently certifies via public notary that the ballots and paper records have been destroyed. Prohibits sending or voting via fax, and makes it a Class C felony to intentionally open or tamper with ballots without express authorization of the director. That's the point of this, is this election integrity, trying to make it better after some of the things we've seen in the past. I'm going to go ahead and have my staff put themselves on the record this time and walk us through. And as always, if we get to a point where there's questions at that time, feel free to ask. I don't anticipate this will take too long. My intent today is to have an intro on the bill. I'll just throw it out for the public record. There's an audit being performed right now on the system, and we're going to hold this bill into the next session on the interim and take all that aggregate data, including some ideas from the House, into a composite. So this is just an initial rollout. We'll be holding it for a while, but we're going to get it out there in the record for now. So, gentlemen, when you're ready, take it away.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Scott Ogan. I'm the Senior Policy Advisor to the Chairman.
I'm Terrence Shanigan, staff to Senator Schauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll walk through a sectional analysis. Section 1 codifies an opt-in registration to vote on PFD applications. Currently, it's an automatic registration. You fill out a permanent fund application, you are registered to vote. It caused a problem in the last election because one person's vote was not counted because he had a mix-up with not realizing that where he sent his, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, I think the problem was he filled out a different, he mailed his permanent fund application to a different location than where he lived, and so he's registered at his business location, if memory serves me. So we want to make it an opt-in. Section 2 eliminates facsimile language changes to a form of electronic transmission. Section 3 clarifies that the division shall register voters. Section 4 cleans up language with new voter registration protocols. Section 5, the applicant must expressly request to be registered to vote. Section 6 adds a new section requiring the director to establish by regulation a strict chain of custody protocol. And we should say that we met with the Division of Elections. They have protocols now in place. This simply codifies that and requires that they come up with the best practices regulation, so it's clear and there's no ambiguity. It says that all ballots shall be returned to a single point of receipt. Currently, ballots can be destroyed in precinct after the election, which and then you lose track of where the ballots are. We want all the ballots to come back to a central location so they can all be accounted for before the election is certified. It requires that digital reports be treated with the same chain of custody protocols. It breaks in the chain of custody, whether intentional or not. If they're unintentional, they require a notification of the Attorney General, Lieutenant Governor, each affected candidate and organized group that sponsors or opposes an issue on the ballot. Currently, there's nothing in the law that I've been able to find that requires the director to give notification. And in the last election, I was following District 1 pretty closely, and the election board decided to do an audit on the ballots. It significantly changed the count, and there was no one present from either party or either interested party to witness those ballots being handled. So we wanted to close that loophole and make sure that all parties, including if you're an author of an initiative or a group that opposes an initiative or issue on the ballot, that you get reasonable notice as well. Election workers that see an irregularity during the election can call for a hand audit of ballots and records immediately after the polls close in precinct. This is a pretty big departure from normal practice. It may slow down the results of an election for a short while. And when it's election night, those minutes turn into seem like an eternity waiting for returns. But they're not nearly as long as wait, for example, in the last election where we didn't know what was happening for a very long time afterwards. And session got started a month late this year because of that. So we think it's worth the wait. And if there's something that's going on that somebody that one of the election workers sees that says, let's all stop and look at this now instead of the election board going back and after the fact, days or weeks after the fact, and trying to figure out what happened. In the last election, I think, if memory serves me, and I think the director can correct me if I'm wrong, there was a spoiled ballot that was didn't get handled quite right, and they finally figured it out, but it was quite a long time after the election, the polls closed. So be nice to know that night, let's debrief after the mission. And probably one of the biggest things that I think I like the most is we called it an election offense hotline. So we're establishing a hotline, so it basically deputizes voters. If they see something going on, if they see something, they should say something. We're going to give them on every ballot envelope, on every machine, and a couple of places in the election location, a hotline. And here's who you call. And somebody during election, when the elections is in place, including the early voting and absentee voting before. If somebody sees something, there's a number they can call and they can say something. Section 7 requires the division to provide election offense notices and requires notices to be posted. Section 8 outlines protocols for voter notification if the vote is not counted and how to avoid the issue in the future. We're told they do that anyway, but it's more of a policy. It's not codified anywhere that I'm aware of. Section 9, the director may not certify the election until each ballot or paper record is accounted for. Section 10 outlines protocols for ballot destruction, requires a notarized statement of destruction from the director. Section 11 prohibits voting by facsimile. Section 12 is conforming language. Section 13 adds opens or tampers to the existing Class C felonies for malfeasance with ballots. So we're not creating a whole new crime. We're just adding if you you open or tamper with a sealed ballot or ballot package without the express authorization from the director, that's a Class C felony.
Section. Hold on, Scott. Okay. Senator Rumble.
Okay, I'm. Yes, thank you. I was going to wait, but this is kind of important. In the municipal elections, we're getting ballots by mail in Anchorage, and I just find it very interesting that both my sons, and I don't actually even know if they're residents of Alaska anymore, I got ballots from them, and it just kind of like it just seems like they're sending so many out, and you know. This is kind of important. I mean, I guess we would not be able to open them up or do anything, obviously. But it just seems like there's an opportunity there with mail-in ballots that there's some significant concerns. You know, we just ended up throwing them away. But what if someone goes and gets in the trash, you know, and gets them out and sends them in? I don't know if this addresses any of that or not.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Reinbold. This does not address that because that's a municipal election. That's under municipal code. And so the municipalities can run their elections the way they want, and they've chosen to have mail-in ballots. And so this bill would not affect a municipal election.
Through the chair.
Go ahead.
And, you know, I just think I think the discussion needs to continue. You know, and I'm not typically a person for micromanaging local districts, but I think this could impact people in big ways, even at the municipal level. And so, anyway, that's the reason why I understand that it's municipal, and that's why I made sure I said it at the beginning. But I still think that there's opportunities here for people, you know, when they're getting ballots. You know, I just think it's something that we potentially need to discuss in this bill, because I really like this bill, and I think it's super exciting that you brought it forth.
And I will tell you, Senator Rumble, that was one of the things we looked at as well. You talk to other states and get feedback from other people, and they would tell you, you know, for example, Oregon had a bunch of people write in when we filed this, and they go, it's perfect down here, it's great. I'm like, so how do you handle if, you know, a spouse takes somebody else's, you know, the spouse they're having a hard time, or a very aggressive spouse, you know, whatever, and they take it. How do you fix that? There's no answer for it. What if somebody was to go into the garbage because it got thrown away? What's the answer for that? We don't have one. There's a lot of integrity issues with ballots being mailed out that they have no answer for. They'll just claim that it works great, and I don't buy it. I'm a fan of somebody, you know, if you have to have a library card, you know, to rent a book at the library, if you have to have a card to go to the bank to get your checks out or get money or any other number of things, but not require the ability to verify who somebody is for one of our most important and basic rights to vote, that's a problem. So we're trying to go down the vein of what is achievable now, but look at ways to make this system tighter, because I do believe Anchorage going down that path is probably not a wise thing. That's my opinion, but I think there are problems with it, and there's no great answers that I've heard of so far. There was a lot of stories of people getting multiple ballots, people getting no ballots, people in different places. So there's a lot to be said about this and ways we can work on it, and we're probably not going to find all those yet, but we're continuing to work, and that's one of the reasons we're setting this aside after the rollout. Is because we're talking to see what this audit comes up with and where we might tweak things, and then any ideas from that may come across in the House as we get to a complete bill. So we will continue the discussion, and I'll take any feedback you have on things that we might be able to do better as we go through, because that is the intent.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, Scott Ogan for the record. If you direct me to do so, Mr. Chairman, we'd be happy to look into what, if any, authority the state has to meddle in local elections. I don't suspect it'd be much appreciated.
Well received.
By municipalities.
I don't know, but we can certainly ask the question for the discussion. There's nothing wrong with that, I suppose. But I think we all, generally speaking, are a fan of pushing things to the lowest possible level. But we certainly can ask the question and just say it doesn't hurt to ask, you know, what the authority is or et cetera. Senator Cargo, maybe you know. You did quite a bit on this in the past. Any thoughts on that, on the legality of state overreach and municipal elections?
I don't know the specific answer to that. All I know is that we've contracted with some of the AccuVote for them. So beyond that, but I do know that we have to buy a new system this year. It might be interesting to hear what that might look like, both with us and the municipals.
So Scott Ogan again for Senator Schauer. Section 14 and 15 are conforming language. Section 16 codifies the date when the bill and when the changes in the bill apply. Section 17 authorizes the department to adopt necessary transition regulations, and Section 18 establishes an immediate effective date so they can adopt those regulations for transition. Section 19 establishes an effective date for the rest of the bill, and that's my sectional analysis if anyone has any questions.
Terrence, I think you had something to add there a second ago.
This is Terrence Hannigan on the record. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to suggest that we have the director for the Division of Elections here today, may be able to answer the question dealing with the mail-in ballots and the state's influence over local elections. I know that we've, as we worked on the language here, we still are doing some legal research in terms of how the state can put limits on elections in general and state resources, even if they're not financial resources, but if there's shared technology, shared network, shared services, how if we put limits at a state level in terms of mail-in ballots or restrictions, how that could impact or curtail how municipalities approach elections and what the influence that has. So perhaps the question can be answered a little better.
I should have mentioned that, by the way. She is here, and I appreciate her taking the time on a Thursday evening to come in or afternoon. But that being said, we have questions of her directly, or if you just don't mind coming up to the hot seat for a minute and maybe answer what questions we've asked that you might have answers to and any further ones.
Good afternoon. Gail Fidumiai from the Division of Elections. Director. So the question about mail-in ballots through the chair, Senator Reinbold. The municipality of Anchorage gets the list from the Division of Elections, and any registered voter who claims an intent to return to the state of Alaska can continue to remain a registered voter. We can't cancel a voter registration unless the voter notifies us in writing that they wish to cancel the registration. So a large part of the onus is on the actual individual to take the time to reach out to us and say, I've moved to Colorado. I'm now a registered voter in Colorado. The state does receive notices from different elections offices throughout the 50 states and notifies us in writing when someone registers to vote there and puts on their form that they were previously registered to vote in the state of Alaska. The Division of Elections also participates in a cross-state project known as ERIC, and we match voter registration lists with other states and various other information and send notices to those individuals as well.
Okay, just a couple questions. So that's where I hope my voice. I plan on returning to Alaska. I don't know when, but it just it's very interesting to me that everybody. What's your list? How big is it with those intending to come back to Alaska? I mean, how many of these do you send out? Do you have any idea?
Through the chair, Senator Reinbold, I do not know. I mean, our registration rolls are about 550,000 right now, but we don't keep, I don't know how many people actually are physically present in the state at this time.
Just through the chair. So basically what I'm trying to figure out, like let's say the population of Alaska is 320,000. Let's say there's 200 registered voters, but you're sending out 300,000 because some of them left and they have an intent to return. I mean, that could have a significant impact on elections. It is just something, it's a very premature discussion right now, but it's just something that caught my attention when there's two ballots, you know, on our counter when I show up in Juneau for the municipal election in Anchorage. I'm like, what the heck are these doing here? Why did they come here? And could someone be tempted, you know, in some household? We threw ours away, but then I was like, gosh, do I shred these? I didn't know what to do with them, really. But anyway, I just think it's something. And is there a penalty? What's the penalty on a municipal level, you know, for doing something like that? I don't know.
Through the chair, Senator Reinbold, I do not know what the penalties at the municipal level would be for something like that. The division does strongly encourage residents who receive mail that is not for them to somebody else who still has a mailing address there to return that to the Division of Elections so then we can proceed with updating our records.
Through the chair. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so basically it's up to whoever moves out to contact you, it sounds like. I didn't even know that was something that...
There might be an interesting thing here. Can you give just a little bit for the record and the public's information on how, because what Laura's talking about, there is a scrub that you do. Can you kind of go through that timeline and kind of just throw that out because it might help? It's not like they're on there forever, but people are probably very interested because I didn't know what the timeline was either until we started having meetings and going through all the information. So could
certainly
you do that?
Through the chair and members of the committee. The division conducts an annual list maintenance, which was formerly known as purging the voter rolls, and it's based off of the requirements of the National Voter Registration Act. And every year, we look back for 4 years to see who hasn't voted, who has had mail returned as undeliverable, or who has had no contact with the division, and then they are targeted for what we call list maintenance and sent notices. They're sent a first notice. If that first notice comes back undeliverable, they're targeted to be sent a second notice. If they don't respond to that second notice within 45 days, they are then removed from active status to inactive status and remain in that inactive status for the following two general elections, and then they are completely removed from the rolls.
Well, through the chair, I'm just not a fan of mail-in ballots. I'll just be, you know, this kind that are just sent blanketly out. You know, if you order a ballot, I understand that. But this blanket sending them to everybody, I really think that it has the potential to impact elections. And so, anyway, I thank you for what you do. I really should say that. I know you have a really tough job, and I personally want to thank you. I know you've been doing it quite a while. I haven't had any problems with Division of Elections. It's actually been a pretty smooth process through the whole, you know, 10 years or so that I've been involved in this. But I really did want to say thank you.
Mostly they've been very helpful, and you know, we came in with a big list of things. We cleaned some of them up and said, oh, that's okay, or that's fine. They said, well, what about these? And we're working on it. So far we found it to be a really good process, and you've been very open and helpful in providing information. So it's going to take us a little bit of time on this one, but the intent is still to try to get a bill through the next session. So next year, we know we're not going to do it this year, and there's data that we still have to collect. So is there anything else you want to just bring up while we're well, you know, I'll just defer because I saw a hand over here. So Senator Coghill.
Thank you for introducing the bill. First of all, one of the things I like in here, and maybe get an opinion from the department, the opt-in on the permanent fund, I think, is a cleaner way of doing things. It's more positive that people actually make a choice rather than you have to confirm a choice. Any procedural glitches on that?
I'm through the chair, Senator Coghill. I don't believe there would be procedural glitches. It would relieve some administrative burdens on the division and be a cost savings to the division, for which when this process was implemented, the division did not receive any funding to implement it. And so the money that we're using to do the permanent fund opt-out notices could be better spent on other things that we've had to put aside.
Yeah, we heard that last year and we just couldn't get there. So then the other question is this whole new chain of custody question is going to come to us probably in kind of a heavy way as we go into the next election cycle. So, before we get to the chain of custody question, explain to me what we're going to have to do in our electronic voting, because I know that the AccuVote system has to be switched out, if I understand correctly, from the last budget we talked about. So help me understand the timing on that, and then the chain of custody questions. In if you've looked at this law, those chain of custody questions with regard to any new system. I know you, I think you're in a bidding process, or have you landed bids?
Through the Chair, Senator Coghill, we are in the process of reviewing bids and hope to have a successful bidder within the next couple of weeks and moving forth with issuing a contract in July. And the system will be another precinct-based system similar to what we have now with paper ballots and an accessible voting unit in every precinct, which is required by the Help America Vote Act.
Okay. All right, so chain of custody question is going to be really the same kind of question that we'd have under AccuVote.
Through the Chair, Senator Coghill, the way I understand the chain of custody is post-election, like the right. way the voted after the ballots are voted and returned, and there are some pretty heavy requirements that are in the bill, and we definitely need to take the time to look through them and compare to what our current processes are to see what exactly we would need to change.
Yeah, it looked pretty heavy-handed to me, but in the elections where nationally we've heard about boxes ended up in the back of somebody's car or left at the airport and all that stuff, you know. So I don't think that's happened in Alaska other than a couple of real what you'd call technical glitches. So far, so good. There is one word that I had one of my staff members pick out that I thought I'd ask you about, and that is under the new section, under the chain of custody. you don't have to answer now, but they asked for a review, an audit to certify the ballot accounting. Should that be auditing? And so it's just the audit process. That's on page 4, line 9, just for what it's worth. Just circle that word. We don't have to answer the question now, but...
Through the Chair, Senator Coghill, the State Review Board now does what we call an audit of the election. They go through each and every precinct register and identify the number of ballots that were counted by the electronic voting equipment compared to what's been reported. They look at the number of signatures in the precinct register. So they do the same for question and absentee ballots. So they essentially do perform an audit. I wouldn't consider it to be in the same terms as what a CPA would do as considering an audit or something similar to that, but the State Review Board is an existing process that we do at this point in time.
Probably a broader question then. I'll get off of getting into the details of the bill because I understand we're going to go through this, and I'll probably come to you and ask you a dozen questions along the way. But in a broader sense, in our voting, probably staff training is as important as the actual system that we're running, right? And from your perspective now, having been in and then coming back and you looked at what we have for tools for our staffing, we ran aground at least in one place in staffing issues, and it was either misunderstanding or overt action on one of our North Slope voting questions that happened where they were passing out a couple of different ballots. But now that you have had a chance to run it in one segment and skipped over an administration or so, staffing, tell us what we're coming into as we look for volunteers, those who can help us with our issues on our voting. Just a general perspective.
Through the Chair, Senator Coghill, as far as full-time permanent staff in the division,
no, I'm thinking about those
election workers.
The reason I'm asking is the highly technical nature of this, and if we start adding more and more requirements about how things are handled, those who volunteer might say, not me. You know, that's kind of what I'm getting at.
Through the Chair, Senator Coghill, that could be a very real problem. We rely on individuals to already perform a significant chunk of very important duties during an election, and they work, you know, anywhere from 14 to 16-hour days. There is a lot of responsibility that is put upon them, and they don't get paid a whole lot to do that either. We would definitely do the best we can to train and to ensure that they understand any new policies and procedures that would be in place. We will be doing a more intense training coming up for the 2020 elections already anyway, in light of the fact that we would be getting new ballot tabulation equipment. So we would hopefully be able to incorporate anything else. It is a big undertaking to implement a new ballot tabulation system. And so to implement that on top of some pretty significant other changes is going to be challenging.
One other question.
Before you get to that one, John, Scott, I think, had a specific answer to one of yours a question ago. So before we forget about it, I want to make sure we covered it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Scott Ogan. The biggest chain and the biggest change in the chain of custody would be making sure all the ballots come back. And I had a fair amount of experience. I managed a team of attorneys and other disciplines that prosecuted and defended litigation for the state and DNR, and we had very strict chain of custody protocols with evidence that were that was already been requested in discovery, and we had some very severe penalties if we broke those chains of custody. My colleague Terrence Shanigan was a former state trooper, and we had the discussion. He goes, you know, if you broke chain of custody on evidence, your criminal case is over. You know, so plus we are giving the department or the division, ability to come up with their own regulations on what the best practices are. And frankly, I was pretty impressed with the practices that they do have. They have seals on the envelopes and the shipping containers and those kind of things. So I think they've got a pretty good system now. There would be a pretty big hammer. Someone intentionally breaks the seals or has some kind of malfeasance with the paperwork on the chain of custody. Because you always, when the chain of custody, you have to sign the paperwork. Yeah, you've got custody of it now, and then you're responsible for that until the next person has custody, and you have to sign off on that piece of paperwork. So There's a chain of paperwork that goes with a chain of custody, and the people's names that are on that are responsible. So, and if something happens under their watch, there's kind of a big hammer there, but it has to be intentional. So, you know, if they roll the thing across the table and the seal breaks, they're not going to jail, you know, but they certainly better document that happened and bring it to somebody's attention. So, that's all I had to say.
And you had another question?
Only one last question, and this is with regard to the hotline. My guess is there's probably about maybe three times in a year that hotline would probably be used, and that would be primary elections, general elections, and then the counting time period where certification is coming up. So is that something that you think as a department that you can – just kind of receive that information, then you have to become a detective based on what you hear. So just as a practical matter, how do you see that hotline working?
Through the chair, Senator Coghill, well, the division does currently have a hotline that people can call to file complaints. It was required because of the Help America Vote Act, and we would think that number could still be used to fulfill the requirements of this statute. We would take the information from the individual and look into it, but we don't have an investigative department to be able to go out and research each and every incident. So that would have to be something we'll have to discuss.
Right. I'm learning all along the way. Thank you.
As we are as well. As I mentioned, this is still something we're working on. We didn't think we would get to this year. And as we've also found, some of the initial questions we had going in, we already have answers. They've got a process that we're comfortable with, and it makes sense. There's other areas we think we can do better, and so that's just what we're looking, like I said, for areas where we can tighten this up, and we don't have that all completely vetted yet. And we may find a few more things as we go through it and decide, hey, that's a good idea, or we're not going to do that. So we're just in, for lack of a better term, the discovery process of trying to make sure that areas that we can fix loopholes if we find them, or things that we could do better, even if it might include some funding. It's a fiscal note to it, because right now it doesn't, but it might. And if it makes sense, we'll look at entertaining that thought. Because, again, I think this is a very important thing. It's one of our more important civic duties is to vote, even though people don't think about that. And I'll give you an example. If you go to Iraq, after they had the invasion in 2003 and Saddam Hussein was gone, they had people that were braving. You know, my son was there. I've been there, you know, military veterans. John's a veteran as well. And there were people literally, and it's not an exaggeration, that were dying to get to the polls, to have the right to vote. And we over here blow it off all the time, like, ah, voting, my vote doesn't matter. And they're literally people dying, braving the streets where gunfire and things were happening and suicide bombers to get there to get the thumbprint so they could get the ink on the finger to show I have the right to vote. It was amazing to watch. And it's an important thing that we sometimes take for granted, and I think we just want to make sure that we honor that by making this as good as it can be. Scott, do you have another comment?
I close with one thought, sir, to that very same thought. There's people that have died in our country for this cherished right, and that's why we need to take it seriously and make sure everybody that votes counts, because we used to punch holes in ballots before the electronic ballots was, and I used to, before the electronic ballots existed, and I used to speak to Boy State every year when I was in this body and the other body, and I used to always open up my remarks with, you know, in other countries there's revolutions, and if you want to vote, you have to vote with a gun, and you have to punch holes in somebody, and in this country, we just punch holes in paper. And we have a revolution. So that's why it's so important.
Yes, our own country started that way, I believe. Something to do with tea. Speaking of, Scott, I know you came in late, so I'm going to open it up if you want to go ahead and ask some questions or anything till now. I know we're going to come back to it as we get into next year or so. Any following
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity today, and the division does look forward to working with you on this bill in the future.
Any further comments from the committee at this time? As we're getting towards the end of the season. Okay. Thank you for taking time to appear. You both cleared off the hot seat. Thanks. We're going to go ahead and set this bill aside. Do not anticipate bringing this back up again until next session, just so you know, so everybody can forget about it for a while, think about it over the session, come back in with your ideas. But we will be reaching out to committee members as we find information and think about the direction we might take. This concludes our business for today. The Senate State Affairs Committee will be meeting again on Tuesday, May 7th, 2019, at 3:30 p.m. back in this room. Potentially to hear bills previously heard. What we're really looking for is any things we might have coming across from the House, et cetera, last minute. So at this point, it's winding down, but just stand by. We'll let you know. This time, there's no other business before the committee. We're going to adjourn. Let the record reflect. Time is 4:12 p.m.